This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. The death toll from the partially collapsed condominium building in Surfside, Florida has risen to 18 after authorities said six more bodies, including two children, were found in the rubble on Wednesday. Officials said 147 people are still missing, but they remain hopeful of finding survivors. State authorities have asked for another search and rescue team to help find them. About half of the 12th floor, 136-unit condominium building collapsed last Thursday. Since then, rescuers have slowly picked their way through the rubble using cranes, infrared scanners, and dogs. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden are scheduled to visit Surfside later today. Authorities in Indonesia say rescuers are searching for 11 people still missing after a passenger ferry sank off the coast of Bali in rough seas, killing at least seven others. Dozens of survivors were plucked from the water Tuesday evening after the ferry, carrying 57 passengers and crew, went down at the western end of the Holiday Island. It was unclear what caused the accident. Marine accidents are common in Indonesia, an archipelago of more than 17,000 islands, where many use ferries and other boats to travel despite poor safety standards. The U.S. House of Representatives has launched a new investigation of the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The House approved a special committee to probe the violent attack as police officers were injured fighting that day, watched from the gallery above. The vote was along party lines, just two Republicans voting yes with Democrats. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi last week says she would have preferred an independent panel to lead the inquiry, but Senate Republicans blocked that. Via remote, this is VOA News. The premier of the Australian state of New South Wales urging people in Sydney and surrounding areas to reduce their movements. 24 more cases were recorded on Thursday. The premier warned the lockdown could fail if residents don't minimize their activities. On Wednesday, the Queensland and Western Australian state governments advised people under the age of 40 not to take the AstraZeneca vaccine because of the risk of a rare blood clotting disorder, despite the shots available to all adults. Australians have a choice of only two vaccines, and locally manufactured AstraZeneca is more plentiful. President Joe Biden announced on Wednesday during a virtual meeting with governors that Western states vulnerable to wildfires and suffering from drought amid the extreme heat here in the U.S. are to receive more help from the federal government. Biden said federal firefighters would get a boost in their minimum wage and be kept on the job as long as needed beyond the traditional wildfire season. Because of climate change, battling wildfires is no longer a seasonal job. The president said it's a year-round mission. Bill Cosby back home in his suburban Philadelphia home after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned Cosby's sexual assault conviction, allowing him to be released from prison. Cosby, who is 83, served nearly 3 years after being found guilty of drugging and violating a Temple University sports administrator, Andrea Costin, at his suburban Philadelphia home back in 2004. Attorney Lisa Banks says that while Cosby's release from prison Wednesday didn't change the facts of the case, it felt like a setback for the Me Too movement. The Prime Minister Imran Khan Wednesday denounced as idiocy his country's past policy of becoming a frontline state in the U.S.-led war against terrorism in Afghanistan, blaming the policy for the persistent security and economic challenges facing Islamabad. Khan again ruled out the possibility of providing Pakistani bases to the U.S. military for counterterrorism strikes in Afghanistan following the planned withdrawal of U.S. troops from neighboring country after nearly two decades. Speaking Wednesday, Khan criticized President Biden's unexpectedly fast-paced troop withdrawal, simultaneously asking Pakistan to use its leverage to push the Taliban to the negotiating table to find a political settlement to the war. By remote, Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Even though the Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray, aid agencies are warning that over 1.6 million people in the region's hard-to-reach areas are in need of urgent food aid. There is also the issue of Eritrean forces still in the area.
Eritrean forces still remain in Tigray illegally, especially on the eastern parts of Tigray. They continue to loot, to destroy.
Mezagide Gebremadin is a human rights activist at Omna Tigray, an advocacy group established in response to the conflict in Tigray. And Somalia's opposition politicians and the public have welcomed a deal to hold delayed indirect presidential elections in October. And lawmakers in East Africa have called on member states to find alternative mechanisms to fund the community projects.
The reality is actually these organizations never received the funds that they were supposed to receive. A lot of this is because partner states are not making contributions on time.
Aden Abdikadir is a lawmaker from Kenya. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. And for our top story, we go to the Horn of Africa in Ethiopia. Now, even though the Ethiopian government has declared a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray, aid agencies are raising alarm about the fate of over 1.6 million people in the region's hard-to-reach areas. They say that people in these areas are in need of urgent food aid, with at least 33,000 severely malnourished children facing, quote, imminent risk of death. USAID says that some aid groups are expected to test the ceasefire as soon as possible in an effort to reach remote areas. Mezagide Gebremadin is a human rights activist at Omna Tigray, an advocacy group established in response to the conflict in Tigray. She tells me that many Ethiopians in the diaspora with family members in the region are still not able to reach them because the city was left without electricity, internet, or telephone connections.
After that, the Tigray government and the Tigray Defense Forces have taken over the city and majority parts of Tigray zone. They're trying to establish stability and to basically try to bring some sort of normalcy to the people on the ground.
There were reports, like you said, of looting and destruction of property, including offices of international NGOs, the UNICEF and others. But we also had that money was taken out of banks in Mekelle. How are people surviving without access to their funds?
Exactly. For that reason, the situation in Tigray and for the most part in Mekelle is quite dire, because people still don't have access to humanitarian aid. And as you said, the banks have been looted, so people don't really have any cash to depend on. And to make matters worse, there is complete communications blockout imposed by the Ethiopian federal government. And we're not even able, you know, to hear what exactly is happening since yesterday. And it's for that reason that we continue to call on the international community to immediately intervene and provide the life-saving humanitarian aid for those in need.
Are you able to get in touch with your family in Mekelle?
Not really. Just like majority of the Tigrayan diaspora, I haven't been able to hear from my family members that are across Tigray, not only just now, but even before. I wasn't able to hear from my family members. I don't know if they have been exposed to the weaponized rape by the Eritrean army or the Amhara militia. I don't know if they're alive or dead because of the starvation. Or I don't even know if they have escaped the war planes and the drone attacks. So very much worried about my family members, but also the Tigrayan population at large.
Mm. And what do you hope happens going forward? What do you want to see taking place in the next couple of months to achieve sustainable peace in the region?
The first and foremost thing is for the Ethiopian federal government to stop its hostilities across Tigray and also stop attacking Tigrayans that are in different parts of Ethiopia. In addition to that, invading forces from the Amhara region as well as from Eritrea need to immediately withdraw from Tigray so that the democratically elected and constitutionally mandated Tigray government could continue to administer the region. But I also expect the international community to provide much needed humanitarian aid for those starving because of man-made famine, and also provide some sort of protection for the rape survivors and others. I think this will be done if and only if the international community has the political will to bring the Ethiopian federal government as well as the Eritrean government to justice for all the war crimes and crimes against humanity that they have committed for the past 8 months against the people of Tigray.
So, Meza, we've heard that obviously the Ethiopian federal forces have pulled out of Tigray, but also there's another dimension to this conflict, the role of Eritrea. What are you hearing about what they're doing, and have you heard of them possibly leaving that area, that region?
Eritrean forces still remain in Tigray illegally, especially on the eastern parts of Tigray. They continue to loot, to destroy, to rape, and subjugate and to massacre the people of Tigray. Despite the mounting calls from the international community to withdraw from Tigray, they remain to be there, and there are no signs of them leaving. However, the Tigray Defense Forces and the government have just hinted yesterday that if protecting Tigray's interest is going to take Tigrayan forces marching all the way to Eritrea, that they were willing to do it.
That was Meza Gede Gebremadin, an international relations specialist and human rights activist at Omna Tigray, an advocacy group established in response to the conflict in Tigray. I reached her here in Washington, D.C. And lawmakers in East Africa have called on member states to find alternative mechanisms to fund the community projects. This comes as the annual budget of the community decreased for a second consecutive year, despite increases in regional institutions. Moses Havyarimana reports from Arusha.
For the second consecutive year, the East African Community budget shrunk by $7 million for the financial year 2021-2022. With the COVID-19 impacting the region's economy, some member states did not meet even the annual contribution to their community for the ending financial year. Aden Abdikadir is a lawmaker from Kenya.
Anybody looking at this from a financial point of view will say, do these organizations really need more funding? Why are they not utilizing the funds that were given to them? The reality is actually these organizations never received the funds that they were supposed to receive. A lot of this is because partner states are not making contributions on time.
South Sudan is the biggest defaulter in as far as remitting their contribution is concerned, owing the community more than $19 million. East African Community member states are supposed to remit their contribution of $7.8 million annually. Deng Gai is a lawmaker from South Sudan.
Secretariat in the past, and still are, doing a great job, resource mobilization from donors, but not so much when it comes to making sure that our capitals remit.
The East African Community had for the last 5 years studied the modalities of how the community can self-fund without relying on donors, where the more preferable mechanism was to charge 1% of the goods imported in East African Community. Susan Nakauki is a lawmaker from Uganda.
I think it's high time we take the issue of alternative funding seriously. It's high time you did the needful. We can't continue admiring the African Union. Actually, the issue of alternative funding, they borrowed it from ESC. We hired consultants, we paid them, they came up with a good concept paper, AU borrowed it. The same partner states are implementing it that side, and they're not willing to implement it in the East African Community.
Ngwaru Magembe is a Tanzanian lawmaker.
We can either do it in the fuel price formula, or we can do it in the electricity per unit price formula. 10 cents, I think that is something that can be discussed. And once we do that, there will be enough funding for the community.
Low rate absorption by the organs and institution in respect of the activities funded by the partner states was attributed to the movement due to the COVID-19 pandemic, delayed remittances and recruitment of staff. The overall absorption rate stood at 27% of the financial year 2020-2021. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
A separatist leader wanted by Nigeria is in custody in Abuja, awaiting trial on terrorism and treason charges. Authorities say that Nnamdi Kanu, head of the Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB, was arrested Tuesday. Timothy Obiezo has more for VOA.
Authorities say Nnamdi Kanu's arrest was aided by Interpol, but did not say where he was intercepted. Local news sources say he was apprehended in the United Kingdom, but the British High Commission refutes the claim. Kanu was in court for a brief hearing in Abuja Tuesday ahead of a trial set for July 26. He faces charges that include acts of terrorism, treasonable felony, possession of firearms, and managing an unlawful society, according to Attorney General and Justice Minister Abubakar Malami.
Kanu was also accused of instigating violence, especially in southeastern Nigeria, that resulted in the loss of lives and property of civilians, military, paramilitary, police force, and destruction of civil institutions and symbols of civil authorities.
In 2014, Kanu founded the Indigenous People of Biafra, IPOB, which seeks an independent state in Nigeria's southeast. He rebranded a movement which seceded from Nigeria in 1967, leading to a bloody civil war and the defeat of the Biafran movement. Kanu was first arrested in late 2015, but 2 years later fled the country and remained at large, often promoting his separatist agenda on social media and through radio broadcasts from unknown locations. Human rights lawyer Martin Obono questions the Nigerian government's position on Kanu's arrest.
He didn't state what extradition documents were used in order to bring him back to Nigeria. So the entire arrest to us, I mean to me basically, feels like an abduction, because if you're going to move someone from a country, you need to follow certain legal procedures. Was there mutual legal assistance that was used? So all these are kind of very vague. It raises a lot of questions.
In June, the separatists announced an alliance with Cameroon's Anglophone rebels, who seek to create an independent English-speaking state known as Ambazonia. Political analyst Jibrin Ibrahim says IPOB's demands are legitimate, provided they are pursued lawfully.
When a political group or an identity group believes it's significantly marginalized, it's legitimate for them to make demands for separation.
This year, IPOB formed an armed security unit, the Eastern Security Network, ESN, in the southeast. The government's crackdown on the unit has led to a recent rise in tensions. More than 100 security officials reportedly have been killed. Police stations and election offices have also been attacked. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And still in Nigeria, authorities continue to scale up efforts to ensure citizens are fully vaccinated with the available COVID-19 vaccines. But the scale-up of the vaccination exercise continues amid vaccine hesitancy and misconceptions among everyday Nigerians. And from Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports on what vaccinated citizens across Nigeria had to say about their motivation, experiences, and how they battled misconceptions around the COVID-19 vaccination.
Nigeria's goal is to have enough vaccines for 70% of the country's 200 million people by 2022. But vaccine hesitancy among Nigerians remains a challenge. According to a poll by the National Primary Healthcare Development Agency, only 50% of the population would like to be vaccinated. Despite government's repeated assurances, many citizens still believe that the vaccines have long-term side effects. But citizens like Olayemi Ogunwole has been fully vaccinated despite the misconceptions about the exercise.
I took the vaccine because I do not even want to experience COVID-19. I do not want to have it. I think it's a terrible experience.
Other Nigerians like Paul have a different reason for going for the vaccination.
If you are fully vaccinated, that is when you can be let in, especially when you're traveling to Europe or America and Canada. So if you are traveling there, you have to be fully vaccinated.
Outside of Lagos, vaccinated citizens have been sharing their experiences, especially in dealing with misconceptions and other concerns surrounding the COVID-19 vaccine.
Before I went for the injection, I'd been told you have aches and pains, slight feverish condition and all that. But I didn't experience any of that, probably because I rarely do have allergies.
MM took her vaccine in Abuja, Nigeria's capital. She tells VOA how she made up her mind to take the COVID-19 vaccination.
The first thing I did was I went online and I found out what a vaccine is and what it does. It reduces the fatality rate. And I remembered when we were kids, we were given all sorts of injections every day. You go to the hospital to see kids, they come for BCG, polio, and all that. And I took cast my mind back. None of my siblings, we never suffered smallpox, chicken pox, all those measles. We never had any. That was basically why I went to have a vaccine.
In Kaduna State, northern Nigeria, the story is not too different. For Yasmin Maman, she took the vaccination and convinced her husband and two other family members to do the same. But she says the low turnout at the vaccination center took her by surprise.
I thought I'd see a long queue of people really desperate to get the vaccinations. But it wasn't like that. I was the only one.
Yasmin's experience at a vaccination center highlights the need for more work in combating hesitancy among everyday Nigerians who continue to show reluctance for the COVID-19 vaccination.
All the people I advised to go get the vaccinations, none of them agreed to go. They think they will die.
Samuel Okocha for VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Fighting has broken out in a settlement located in the West Coast region of the Gambia, where villagers fought over the issue of voter registration. The Independent Electoral Commission is currently registering Gambians ahead of the country's December 4th presidential elections. Reporter Panderimbai has been following the story from Raleigh, North Carolina, and he has more.
The incident left 5 people arrested and others reportedly injured. 2 local communities, Manduwar Mandinka and Manduwar Wolof, had a showdown on Tuesday morning. These are 2 communities with different ethnicities. Manduwar Mandinka are claiming to be the original settlers of the village. They do not recognize the village head of the other village. Hence, the use of Manduwar Mandinka, said the alcalde of Manduwar Wolof, cannot attest voters to obtain voters' cards, which resulted in the altercation. The voter registration was obstructed and brought to halt. Superintendent Lami Jai is the spokesman for the Gambia Police Force.
The registration could not even take place at the end of the day. So this was why the police deployed some officers of the police intervention unit to keep the peace and also restore normalcy. And then during the course of this, about 5 of the youths at the Manduwar Mandinka area got arrested, 5 youths.
The villagers of Manduwar Wolof have rallied behind their village head. They said the alcalde was legally appointed by the government to head the community.
The police is also engaging with other stakeholders, such as the Independent Electoral Commission and other relevant stakeholders, to find an amicable solution to the situation. And so, as we speak, a suggestion has been made to put up another registration center at the Manduwar Wolof area.
Tear gas was fired to disperse the fighting communities. The situation remains chaotic and tense. Police have been dispatched to guard the village overnight.
Now, we want to send information to the general public, especially to people around the area, because the Mandwar area, because we got information that some people have said they will even go to the second registration center whenever it is being created to go and also disrupt the process. And so this is something that we definitely want to call on the people of Mandwar, especially the Mandinga area, to exercise restraint and allow process to continue as far as the registration is concerned.
Gambians are going to the polls on December 4th, 2021 to elect a post-transition president. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. This week, a Kenyan Court of Appeal formally commenced a four-day hearing on the case challenging the High Court verdict on the constitutional review process, popularly known as BBI. This past May, the High Court declared the BBI constitutional amendment process illegal, unconstitutional, null and void. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the seven-court bench will determine whether Kenya will hold a referendum to amend the constitution or not.
The High Court judge's decision came when the BBI Constitutional Amendment Bill had passed all the hurdles and was headed for a referendum. Interested parties, including BBI principals President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga, as well as Attorney General Kihara Kariuki, appealed the decision. The hearing began with Attorney General laying grounds for the defense teams through the Solicitor General Kennedy Ogeto. He accused the High Court judges of launching personal attacks on the president.
But the learned judges were keen on very personalized attacks against the person of His Excellency the President. To them, the facts and the law did not matter. Neither did precedent nor the sovereign will of the people of the Republic of Kenya. The person of His Excellency the President just had to be found at fault.
Court of Appeal lawyer Kamau Karori, representing the Attorney General, while presenting his two-hour oral submission, said that the five-bench High Court judges denied Kenyans their right to exercise their will when they ruled against BBI.
A million Kenyans had supported this popular initiative, and the court, by one judgment, has put a stop to it and prevented the Kenyan people from determining for themselves whether or not they are happy to have this particular bill passed. Now, remember, finally, my lord, on this issue, and my ladies, that this bill was going to go to the referendum. It's my humble submission that any issue that would be raised regarding the popularity or the suitability of this bill is an issue that would have been raised to the Kenyan people in the referendum for them to decide for themselves. At the end of the day, the final determinant of what is good for the Kenyan people is the Kenyan people themselves. It is not the court, it is not parliament, and this is a right that they were deprived.
A section of Kenyans have exceeded confidence that the Court of Appeal judges will be guided by the Constitution while making the final ruling. Alice Wahome is a member of the National Assembly.
Is that the decision will be guided by the Constitution. The judges will be guided by the Constitution. I have faith in our judiciary. And I have seen the list of the judges. And clearly I know that they are judges of sufficient wisdom, legal intelligence, and independence. And therefore we are expecting that they will make the right decision.
The two BBI principals, President Kenyatta and Odinga, have been passionate about the initiative, claiming it is the way to unite the country and enhance a peaceful future. However, Deputy President William Ruto insists that it is not the right time for the country to hold a referendum, saying the resources should be directed towards mitigating the effects of COVID-19 in the country. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's it for this Thursday, July 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.